the Mellon University Book Podcast. I'm Dylan, and last week I read Haruki Murakami's After the Quake, translated by Jay Rubin and recommended by Dylan Rossi, who's here with me today. Two Dylans, two Mikes. What could go wrong?
Great minds think alike.
Yes. Unlike our last episode where Jen and I collaborated on a review of Rooney's new book, we're taking a different approach today. Dylan and I are going to hone in on a short story specifically, Super Frog Saves Tokyo. I really wanted to open this pod with Mr. Rossi and you say Dylan, just like paying homage to Frog.
Please call me Dylan.
But anyway, Dylan, introduce yourself and tell me why you specifically wanted to talk about After the Quake and why you wanted to specifically talk about Super Frog Saves Tokyo.
Sure. So yeah, I'm Dylan. I'm a senior here at Carnegie Mellon. I'm a physics and creative writing major. And I read this book for the first time in one of my fiction workshops. This was last semester, and I enjoyed the collection as a whole, but Super Frog Saves Tokyo really floored me. When I read it, it was all I talked about for about like a month.
Is this the only Murakami you've read?
This is my first Murakami. I haven't read anything since.
Okay, so basically we're both on the same wavelength here because he's been on my radar for so long.
How could he not be?
Exactly, because my brother was such a big fan and he made me read kind of Kafka on the Shore when I was like 11, which left me so understandably perplexed.
Right.
But he rose to fame in the 80s, came to the States in the 90s and got popular. But I feel like he kind of lost a lot of that traction and momentum, especially among like people our age who I feel like would genuinely enjoy his work.
Sure.
And I wonder if that's due to like the critique of male authors of being somewhat sexist, because have you heard, you've heard.
I've heard the things, yeah. I think that in general puts people off a little bit, especially when you're like a generation removed from when he was publishing a lot of his books. So it's not like quite contemporary anymore. And yeah, I think people are a lot more sensitive to that sort of thing. So, and you get that in some of the other stories in this. You get those hints of like slightly sexist.
Like sex workers. And
sure.
So I have a quote from Miyako Kawakami, who famously wrote Jen, our last guest, her favorite book, Breast and Eggs. And basically she had this interview where she was interviewing Haruki Murakami and she like fully called him out. She was like,
really?
I have the quote. Your work is boundlessly imaginative when it comes to plots, to wells, and to men, but the same can't be said for their relationships with women. It's not possible for these women to exist on their own. And then she goes on to say, like, there's persistent tendency for women to be sacrificed for the sake of the male leads. I'm not mentioning this to like specifically have a discussion about
right,
it.
Right.
I just feel like it's good to acknowledge that there's inherent flaws.
Yeah. No, it's worth mentioning. But I think even then, that's why I like Super Frog Saves Tokyo so much. It's just because it's not playing off of that. I think it almost doesn't give him the opportunity to show.
As someone planning to go into teaching,
sure.
And I know you're more likely to teach physics,
but
let's say for the sake of the argument that you were teaching English, would you include this short story in your curriculum? And how specifically would you teach Super Frog Saves Tokyo?
That's a good one. I would definitely teach Super Frog Saves Tokyo. I think not that I am the most well-read person of all time, and I feel like I'm playing catch up a lot these last couple of years. But in terms of the magical realism that I've encountered, I think this is a fantastic example of just how, for one, I think how subtle you can be with it in a way. I mean, obviously, there's nothing subtle about this giant frog in his apartment, but subtle in the sense of, maybe subtle is not the right word, quiet. I think of how this is very much a story of just here's a guy talking to a frog, and you can kind of, it doesn't feel expansive in the ways that I think a lot of people want magical realism to be.
And I think that is due to the fact that he's so undeniably great at writing characters that are so real despite the situations that they're in. Like, his protagonists are almost always lonely and searching for something, and it's like this combination of fantastical and like deeply human.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think a lot of the time, people a lot of the time think of magical realism in the sense of fantasy. And I don't think they're related. And here I would not classify this as any sort of like a story like fantasy or like the story, the fable of, you know, Super Frog. But I very much think it's about this character, this really lonely, sad character, you know? And I think this is, and we can talk about, you know, if Super Frog is real or not, but...
I don't usually do this as a reader, but I found myself, like, getting caught up in trying to imagine the frog's voice. Like, sure. Normally I don't focus on a character's voice. I just end up picturing my own voice, right. Like, adapting to fit their tone. But this time I kept, like, envisioning a raspy, mafia-esque voice, Michael Keaton, Dave Bautista, sure. Like, something like that.
Dave Bautista.
Like, right? Don't you see, like, Dave?
No, I hear it. But then, like, a lot of, and just in his cadence, he, like, not in terms of the character, but just, like, the way he spoke, he reminded me of, what's his name? The opening scene in Inglourious Basterds.
Oh, that's a great reference.
Just the cadence, very, very formal and highly educated and...
That's not the milk scene. That's the... Are you hiding enemies of the state?
Yes.
Oh, my God.
Christoph Waltz.
Christoph Waltz. Won an Oscar, I think, for that.
Yes.
Yes.
But very, I think similar to that, not as menacing and evil, mm-hmm. you know? But I think in that kind of... That manner of speaking. And I think it's very captivating. And I think in the context of a friendlier character here in Frog, it's really endearing. And so I think you kind of... almost are inclined to believe Frog, like, mm-hmm. to the fullest extent, believe that he exists, believe, like, mm-hmm. I felt very attached to Frog in this story, probably more than any other character in this.
Really?
In this collection, except maybe in the final story.
I didn't feel necessarily connected to the main guy in the Frog one.
I agree.
I don't know if it was this... disconnect between, I don't know, maybe being happier than him. I mean, like, there's these undertones of suicide just, sure. like, completely as, like, the foundation for this story. But Super Frog talks about this invisible threat, Worm.
Sure.
What do you think Worm represents?
I mean, I think probably the most obvious one to go for would be to say that Worm kind of represents just, like, the natural evil of the world, so to speak. Just the way that bad things tend to continuously happen, almost as a force, and in a way that feels out of control. So I think in that sense, he sees what feels like this inevitable danger and this inevitable doom that's going to fall on Tokyo. And I think he then feels compelled... I think he feels a lot of power in the way that he can stand up to that. Like, I think, mm-hmm. I think Frog...
You think Super Frog has power?
I think... Is it Katagiri?
Katagiri, yeah.
I think Katagiri sort of imagines Frog as this... Maybe not an extension of himself, but imagines this kind of story where he has this immense power to save Tokyo, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, you take, like, the realistic perspective. He's not... actually saving Tokyo from Worm.
I also think it's this, like, brilliant dichotomy of being so low in your, like, mortal life.
Sure.
And then having this fantastical creature giving you this, like, praise.
The God complex.
Exactly. Right. Like, you are about to save the world.
Right.
And I thought the way... this is where I disconnected. The way... our protagonist kind of handled both of those differences is maybe not something I related to. I don't know necessarily why, but maybe it was because he felt too calm during these, like, circumstances, which I know sounds, like, obviously because this guy is fictional, but
right.
but there was something unrealistic even about the protagonist that kind of was equivalent to how unrealistic the Super Frog was.
Sure. What do you mean? He's totally real.
The protagonist?
The frog.
I know.
Yeah, it's tricky. I mean, I think for one, it's hard to connect to him because I think he's in a darker place than we usually see characters, because he's not only, you mentioned like this, like suicidal themes, and he talks about he doesn't know why he's alive, but I almost think it's sadder in a way, in the sense that he almost seems like he's beyond suicide in a sense. Like he almost seems like he's resigned to just live out his life like this. He's not even looking for a change so much. At least the way where we find him in the beginning, he seems very much empty, you know, I think, going through. And not in a way where he's actively looking to do something about it, even if it's something as severe as suicide.
Something that comes to mind right now that I wasn't really thinking about after reading is the fact that he gets shot twice in the middle of the book, but it turns out he doesn't, and basically he just fell unconsciously to the floor and kind of stuck in this hospital ward or something weird like that. I don't know the purpose of that still, you know, because there's so many things that are obviously metaphorical and symbolic, but that choice for Murakami to say this character is going to think he died and then just continue kind of living on his regular life was strange.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a really strange moment that I also, it's probably the part that I understand the least, and I have like,
yeah,
I don't
totally.
Have a, I have a very un, I don't have like a clear opinion on it.
There's also not really an answer. It's just,
no, there's not a clear answer.
It's the fact that he's such an absurdist that I'm just so curious what was the point of that, because I feel like his writing, everything is so purposeful.
Yes.
Every line, you can take it apart like Chekhov, like it is so just like
pointed. It's very deliberate.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, I think like, and considering just what the story is aiming for, this read to me like at least I approach this like it's a story about trauma in a way, and especially in this case, the reeling from the earthquake that this is centering around. All the stories, you know, based on after the 1995 Kobe,
yeah,
or earthquake. And I, that was another thing that I appreciate, is just how that detail is always kind of almost implied sometimes, or given in like one line. Mm-hmm. But it feels, when I think the more I think about it, the more it feels central to the story. And even in this case, where I think he's reeling from this disaster that's happened, you know?
Yeah.
And it almost,
he also mentions that his, tragic family passed.
Right.
Family all
parents
perished.
Are dead.
Yeah.
Yeah. His brother and sister married off and basically
took advantage of him.
Don't talk to him anymore. Yeah. So I think it's almost like this earthquake really shakes his world, in the sense that it almost gives him an opportunity to develop this like savior complex. And I think the net result of it is he comes out of this feeling a little more purposeful. I think at the end, when he's laying in the bed, he, you know, even in like the tangible things, like he's ready to read Anna Karenina.
Oh my God. I didn't know this like prior, even though I should have, because Norwegian Wood is literally named after the Beatles song.
Sure.
Like I never really knew that part of the reason why Murakami was so famous was for like these like Western influences in his work.
Yeah.
And I feel like for many writers, referencing popular media or books can just totally disrupt the flow of the narrative. But I think he does it in a way that feels natural and kind of prompts us to think more deeply, like, what is he trying to convey here? Like, how does this element shape our universal understanding of the book? Because it's weird, you know? It's so him. It's so the author on the page when he starts referencing.
Totally.
Because it really has kind of nothing to do with the story besides...
Not at all.
Besides, this is my advice, but I'm just going to quote, like, this amazing piece of work to like convey my message.
Right, I think it's hysterical that Frog is like really well read.
It's so. I saw Dylan this morning and I was like, what a well read frog.
Most learned frog.
Yeah.
I know.
No, please,
what do you make of Frog's apparent death in the hospital?
I don't know what to really make of the way he died, because it was so awfully like, again, gruesome, but I don't know what it did for Katagiri to see that, because he sees the frog and he's obviously like upset about like his death, but
right.
I think maybe it's the fact that because Super Frog is so super, he's almost more defeatable than Katagiri.
A little bit. I also think, usually I don't like when books do this, but it almost, there's some, it's something like a reference to Jesus in a way. Of just the idea.
I felt some biblical references in this.
The idea of Frog, like, I mean, not only like dying for Tokyo, you know, to save Tokyo. And there's that kind of like, you know, died on the cross sort of thing. But it feels like in a sense, he also dies for Katagiri. And he also symbolizes like, he's like the ultimate force of good, that he would go to fight Worm alone and die fighting Worm to save Tokyo. I think it's like a needed sense of inspiration and her like heroism in Katagiri's life.
You need to experience loss to excel in a way. And I wonder if that's what he was getting at.
I think a little bit, yeah. He's someone who's... This is the only way that this character could have lost something. Because he describes how he basically has nothing. His life is empty. And he says that's why he's a tough guy. Because mm-hmm. there's almost nothing that to be taken from him. Mm-hmm. Except his life. And then I think here, this feels like a loss for him. You know, someone like Frog comes into his life. And
God complex.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think it's like a new level of loss to him in a way that again, I think leaves him at the end of the story in a, not in like a better place, but I think prepared to try a little harder, kind of aim for something more. You took it as more.
I didn't, you know what, to be completely honest, I didn't take it as optimistically as that.
Really?
Yeah. No.
How'd you read the ending then?
I read the ending as not necessarily negative, just this was something that happened in Katagiri's life, and now he will continue on as just as he was before.
You don't think he'll change because of this?
I know that is very pessimistic of me, but I feel for some freaking reason, I was so reminded of Eternal Sunshine of a Spotless Mind.
Love that movie.
I know you like that movie, but like, weren't you reminded, or not like reminded of the movie, because that would be insane if like we both were reminded of that movie while reading this, because it really doesn't connect at all. But there is a sort of feeling that I felt after watching that movie that was very similar to the feeling I felt after reading this short story.
Well, I think it's the feeling of going on this, what feels like this really wild, almost trippy journey, and then coming back almost to where you started. And this...
It creates,
I think stories that do that have this really haunting feeling where you feel like a lot has happened and it's just kind of lingering elsewhere. And it's partly like memory and it's...
And it's scary because I think about my own life and I think about things that happen and the fact that like the greater reason maybe might not exist, you know? And that... Wow, this is getting deep.
Shit.
Yeah. Would you say that this story, and you can opt out of this one too.
Sure.
Would you say this story changed how you view challenges in your own life? And if so, what way?
So I think it depends on the kind of challenge. Like, I think if we talk about challenges, like I read this during like a fiction workshop. And so when I think it was, you know, quote unquote required reading. I mean, our professor dropped it from the syllabus, but I still wanted to read it anyway. Cause I'm like, may as well
because
take the time.
Nerd.
Cause I'm a nerd. I read it. And then I think it's changing the way that I try to approach fiction in the sense of like, I think this story makes it feel like there's a lot more I can do just with imagination. I find it's very hard to really be imaginative in this kind of way.
That's so true.
And I think a lot of it rests on not caring so much about like the little details that dictate the world. And I think here, you know, the story reads so smoothly just because it's not bogged down in the logistics of frogs so much.
This might be universal to a lot of authors who write short stories, but I like the fact that it's so simplified in a way where, like, we don't really know a lot about Katagiri's life and romantic partners and this and that, but we don't really need to because we've established this character already, and that's all we need to know.
Right, and I think when you have these simplified characters, I think it lends itself to these much, like, grander readings of it, which is why we're here talking about, like, meaning and, you know, the implications for humanity of Frog and Worm. I think it would start to feel less, the grandiose of it would kind of fade, and it would feel, I think, more like some guy's weird dream.
Yes.
You know, which this doesn't feel like after I read it. It doesn't.
It doesn't. And I know that's what it is. He wakes sure. up and, you know, the nurse is like, oh my God, you were having another nightmare. But it doesn't feel like this Alice in Wonderland and she woke up.
Not at all, right?
Yeah, absolutely not. But Dylan, thank you so much for recommending me this short story collection. And I honestly recommend it to everyone.
Yeah.
It's brilliant. He's brilliant. And I hope you enjoyed chatting.
I did. It was a great time.